Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange. Not a day goes by that we don't hear something about the next race for the White House. It can get confusing. I've already had to catch myself a few times and remember that it is not 2016 yet. The first primary is around 6 months away, but with 17 declared Republican candidates and 5 Democrats out there and Donald Trump looming over it all, it sure feels like someone will be voting soon. Today, we cast our gaze backwards to the last presidential election. Dan Balz of The Washington Post wrote the book Collision 2012. We'll revisit that interview from 2013 in a moment with the usual reminder that since it's recorded, we can't take new phone calls or emails. Dan Balz is the author of Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. Dan Balz is the chief correspondent of The Washington Post, its former national editor, political editor, White House correspondent, and Southwest correspondent. He also co-wrote The Battle for America 2008. Dan Balz, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
You write early in the book that at times the plain nuttiness of the campaign called out for Hunter Thompson to cover it. So it felt to you pretty much as it felt to people watching it, huh?
Well, it did. I mean, the Republican contest in particular went through so many ups and downs and unexpected twists and turns that nobody could quite predict it. And it was even hard to describe it in all its fullness in the traditional way we report. And I stole that line from a colleague, David Marinus, who said to me one day, he said, with all due respect to, you know, political reporters like yourself, we really need somebody else to be able to tell this story in the way it needs to be told. So it was a campaign in which, again, particularly in those Republican primaries, where you had a series of kind of unexpected people rise up to the top of the polls, whether it was Donald Trump, who never became a candidate, or Michelle Bachmann briefly, or Herman Cain, who in the end turned out to be an implausible presidential candidate, but nonetheless had a moment when he was competing, at least in the polls, competitively with Governor Romney.
And the book does a really good job of detailing the circumstances that led to each one of those particular whack-a-mole episodes in which a new candidate seemed to pop up as the leader in the polls for a while. You must have known at the outset of the campaign you were going to write the book. Did that change the approach to reporting it at all?
Well, you can never, you know, as one of my editors said to me, you can't write the beginning of a book like this till you know the ending. And so you go into a campaign with some, obviously, preconceived notions, and I must say many of the preconceived notions I had fell away pretty quickly. I mean, just in terms of, for example, who did and who did not run for the Republican nomination. There were some people who we thought might be candidates who didn't turn out to be, and there were some people who ran who were given very little chance and who actually acquitted themselves rather well. And so you're constantly kind of recalibrating, and having covered campaigns for a long time, I mean, I know that humility is an important part of being a political reporter, and I thought it was particularly the case in the 2012 cycle.
Given that, first of all, when do you even think about this as the beginning of the 2012 cycle? Because it seemed like when you hear about some of the events going on in Washington on Inauguration Day, like the fair number of Republicans, I guess, from Congress getting together and saying, let's not help Obama at all. But that's not necessarily directly to the presidential campaign. But the point being that it seemed like the presidential campaign for 2012 pretty much began about January 20th of 2009.
Yes, it did. And I think that's the nature of our politics. So you could argue that the 2016 campaign began the day that Barack Obama took his second oath of office. And I think there is always, for better or worse, a hunger to look forward and to anticipate. But the other factor on this is that when a party is out of power at this point, there are two calculations they have to make. What do they do in terms of cooperating or opposing an incumbent president, and what do they do to put themselves in the best possible position in order to be able to win the White House the next time it's available? And I think that we saw the Republican opposition rise up very, very quickly in 2009, and we saw the fruits of that in the 2010 midterms when the Republicans gained a net of 63 seats in the House of Representatives. And so, I mean, my feeling was that the 2012 cycle truly began with those midterm elections, as it sort of set the table for what was to come.
Dan, you mentioned having preconceived notions, most of which had to be dispensed with along the way. Were there times when you thought certainly, let's say after the 2010 elections, that Barack Obama was dead meat? And were there people on the Republican side you thought for sure would be the next president?
Well, I would say no to both of those. I always thought that the president would have a difficult reelection campaign because primarily because of the economy. I thought he was as vulnerable as any incumbent we had seen dating back to George H.W. Bush in 1992, who lost his reelection campaign. But when you are running for reelection as an incumbent president, you have certain built-in advantages. And so as you looked at his situation at the end of 2010, or even at the end of 2011, what you saw was a president whose approval ratings were in a kind of a nebulous danger zone. They were certainly not high enough to make him feel at all comfortable about winning, but they were not, for example, so low, which is to say in the low 40s or down into the 30s, where you would say this is going to be a very, very difficult struggle, and he's likely to lose that. And the second was the state of the economy, which in a similar way was neither good enough to say, well, he's a shoe-in for re-election, both because of, you know, the continuing high unemployment and the fairly anemic growth rates, but not so bad that it assured his defeat. In that sense, the economy was not growing rapidly, but it was growing. And so he was in a danger zone. And so I thought he would have a tough race. In terms of the Republicans, you know, I always thought that Governor Romney was the favorite for the nomination, and that whoever won the nomination would have a decent chance to win, depending on how some of the other forces turned out.
Right. And the other forces are well laid out in the book, Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. Dan Balz is its author and our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. And you'll hear more of that interview when we come back in just a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're revisiting an interview from September of 2013 with Dan Balz, the chief correspondent of The Washington Post. He wrote Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. So we get to take a little breather from the race for the White House 2016 and look back at the race for the White House 2012. Here again, Dan Balz. A reminder, no phone calls and emails in this segment, please. Dan, was it hundreds of people you got to interview, from the presidential candidates themselves all the way down to anonymous campaign operatives?
Yes. I mean, there. I had probably more than 200 recorded interviews. Now, some of those were repeat interviews. There were some people in the campaigns who I probably interviewed half a dozen or more times at different intervals as we went along. But when you add it all up, yeah, it's several hundred people who were contributors to the book.
It seemed like that, well, now it seems like maybe for the past three elections and maybe even more than that, we keep hearing this is the most important election of our lifetimes or variations thereof, which must make the eyes of political correspondents roll. But this election was different in the sense that this was also the first post-Citizens United presidential election, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And I think that was an important factor in what we saw in the way campaigns operate. And I think that what we'll continue to see in 2014 and 2016 and beyond. I mean, the rise of the so-called super PACs is a new factor and force in our politics. I think we're still trying to figure out just how significant a force it is. You could argue that in the Republican primaries, super PACs played a big role, both in behalf of Governor Romney and in helping candidates like Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum stay alive at times when they otherwise might have been forced to the sidelines from lack of money or lack of support. In the general election, the super PACs spent a ton of money, and yet it's not clear that they had anything approaching a decisive impact on how the race turned out. So, but I think what we're seeing with these super PACs is, you know, is a force in politics that we've not seen before. They are acquiring good political talent in the sense that that political operatives want to go to work for them because these PACs have a lot of money to spend and they spend it freely. And we see that a single individual can now, with deep pockets, give $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, $10 million, maybe even $20 million to a super PAC, sometimes without having to disclose, you know, their name, to have an influence on the elections. And that's something we've not dealt with before.
And it was Sheldon Adelman, was that his name, who was supported Gingrich and through, what was it?
Sheldon Adelman, yes. Yeah. He was a casino owner in Las Vegas. And he put 10 million or so into super PAC supporting Newt Gingrich.
And made a difference for a while for Newt Gingrich.
Yes, it did.
You get to this, when you talk about some of the preconceived notions you had, obviously the rest of us watching had some preconceived notions as well. And there were certainly times when we thought, for example, that Occupy Wall Street might come out to be something as big as the Tea Party. You do mention Occupy Wall Street as early as page 8 in the book. But at one time, did you think it was going to end up being a big factor, which it didn't?
I was curious about it for this reason. It had captured so much media attention when it began that you looked at that and thought, this, you know, if this takes root as a political movement, it could have real force. The longer I watched it, and particularly as I thought about Occupy movement versus the Tea Party movement, the one thing that it did not seem to have was a sort of an organized political strategy. It certainly put into the conversation themes that carried through to the end of the election, that sort of the notion of the 1% versus the 99%.
And then you add the 47% in there. And the, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So when you split that difference, you get the roughly the 47%.
True.
But what it never was able to acquire, or perhaps never had the ambitions to acquire, was an organizing strategy to have an effect on political campaigns. And so as a result of that, I don't think it had the force in 2012 that the Tea Party had in 2010.
Collision 2012, the book is divided up into three sub-books. Book one, The Pivot. Book two, The Republicans. Book three, The Choice. The Pivot, was this really the move that the White House had to make to stop looking like it was getting beat upon by the Tea Party and look like something that could actually win a campaign?
Exactly. I mean, this is much of this section is devoted to how the Obama team, both in the White House and at the campaign headquarters in Chicago, shifted from the shellacking in the midterm election to putting themselves on true campaign footing by the end of 2011 in order to be ready for the general election as it opened up in 2012. And it looks at kind of the moves by the president initially to try to see if he could get some cooperation and some progress in Congress on some of the fiscal issues, and ultimately the collapse of that strategy. And in a sense, I think the true pivot took place in late August 2011 after the debt ceiling negotiations imploded, and we came up with that quite messy solution that we're still dealing with, frankly, and in which the president and his advisors went into thinking that they were not going to spend any more time negotiating with Republicans in Congress, that they had to take this argument to the country, that this was now a political argument that could only be won or lost through a political campaign. And it was at that point that they began to shift their strategy and their thinking and their rhetoric. And a lot of the research that they had been doing up to that point fed into the kind of the new message that they unveiled in the fall of 2011.
Let us take some calls from listeners. Here's Mark in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dan Balls. His book is Collision 2012.
Yes, one of the reasons that Donald Trump gained a little traction as a potential candidate was because he was standing up, you could say, rhetorically for U.S. economic interests, specifically with regard to China's predatory trade policies. And I thought it was unfortunate that both Obama and Romney didn't see that as an issue. Representative Brad Sherman from California in 2009 was chairman of the House Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Trade, and on C-SPAN's Washington Journal, he said, quote, "You have to have some really bad trade policies to take the most productive nation in the world with the best workforce, and I mean the United States, and turn it into the greatest debtor nation in history, and by God, we've had bad trade policies that have achieved that objective," unquote. And yet Obama's gone around to college students telling them that they are competing against China, which uses their authoritarian regime to extract what is essentially slave labor from their people. So how can we become competitive with China before first becoming slaves like the Chinese workers? And that's really unfortunate that both Obama and Romney essentially condone this kind of totalitarian trade policy and a totalitarian approach to extracting cheap labor from citizens around the world.
All right.
This is further endorsed in a New York Times article titled China's Superior Economic Model, written by who? Andy Stern, former president of the Service Employees International Union. And he based his comments extolling the virtues of China's totalitarian economic model on comments made by the CEO of Intel at the time, Andy Grove. So here we have CEOs, we have union presidents, and U.S. presidents and candidates for presidents extolling the virtues of a totalitarian regime like China and the slave labor policies that they're able to use to grow their economy.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mark. Appreciate it. Sorry, I didn't realize you had more to go there. Dan, that is a question that did seem to come up a bit, was that on business, it seems like there wasn't that great a space between them, certainly in the eyes of a lot of people in the middle of the country.
Well, if you listen to the rhetoric from the two candidates, I think Governor Romney was actually much harsher on China than President Obama. Now, whether he would have carried through with some of the things he talked about is an unanswerable question given the outcome of the election. But he was tougher on the Chinese and some of their practices than was the president. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, the focus of this book is not China and U.S. economic policy, and I'm not an expert on on that at all. You know, this has been a somewhat rocky path for every candidate who runs for president as to how to navigate this issue of free trade versus fair trade versus predatory practices, and also, you know, international relationships that are important. And I've watched every presidential candidate. For the most part, I mean, the pattern is that if you are the challenger, it is much easier to talk tough about China than if you are the incumbent president. We've seen that in a variety of cases. Bill Clinton was a much tougher talker about China when he was a candidate in 1992 than he was as a president and beyond that. So, I mean, your caller makes some very interesting points, and as I say, the focus of the book is not on that. But I think that in these debates, there is a gap between what people say rhetorically and then what they often end up doing once they're in office.
Dan Balz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, chief correspondent of The Washington Post and the author of Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. Don't forget to think of today's interview as something of a time machine. The interview itself was performed several months ago on the air live, and so you'll hear phone calls and emails from the original airing, but we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. But thanks for listening. Here's the other Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Yes, I have two premises that I've heard that I would like your guest to either agree or disagree on. One is I heard on NPR commentators years ago talking about how if the president has a good February in his reelection year, he's almost certain to win. And the other is from Dennis Kucinich this year saying that the 2012 election was fought between the 40-yard lines.
In what sense?
Well, just that the two candidates didn't bother to go anywhere that was really difficult to deal with. They just, you know, babbled back and forth about stuff that was quite easy and didn't really fight each other. I remember in one of the debates, Romney prefaced a great number of his responses by saying, "I agree with the president."
Yeah.
He agreed with him so much, why was he running against him?
Right. All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. So good February and between the 40-yard lines, Dan.
I don't know that I've ever subscribed to the notion that a good February guarantees or reelection or defeat, a good or bad February. I mean, there is a notion that in terms of economic perceptions that what's most important is the sort of the, you know, sometime in the second quarter of the presidential year, that perceptions are somewhere between the second and the third quarter, that perceptions get locked in on the part of the public and that it's hard to change them in the final stretch in the fall if they're already locked in. But I've not heard it isolated to a single month. You know, the view from Dennis Kucinich is one that, A, I would expect to hear from Dennis Kucinich. I mean, he ran for president several times and certainly ran from somewhere outside the 40-yard lines, ultimately not to much success, which may be one reason candidates tend to get a little closer inside the 40s, because they know that the electorate in this country and certainly the decisive part of it is not at either extreme or at either end of the field, but you have to fight it out in the middle. But there, I think there's a broader point that Mark makes, and that is that I shorthanded in the book to say that this was an election about some very big things that was often fought out in some very small ways. And I don't think that either candidate, in a policy sense, broke much new ground, was particularly bold or daring or innovative in what they were offering. I mean, I think that the president was trying to avoid anything approaching a debate on the current state of the economy and his stewardship of it, and so therefore he cast the campaign effectively, I think, as a choice for middle class voters of which of the two candidates they thought had a better sense of their situation or their aspirations or their anxieties and would do more for them in the future. Governor Romney, I thought, though he wanted to elevate the issue of debt and deficits and some of the fiscal issues to a more prominent place, I don't think was ever able to do that, and ran in many ways on what had become Republican orthodoxy dating back some years, some of which had lost its salience as a result of having been tried and not worked often as effectively as Republicans claimed it would work. So there is something to the notion that this was a campaign that tested two philosophies in which neither side quite rose to the moment.
When I think back, for example, to Bush versus Gore, where they were fighting about things like Social Security and the lockbox and all that stuff, and nobody even talked about stuff like threats to America, terrorism, which turned out to be a huge issue, obviously, less than 8 months into the presidency of George Bush. It is often fought, as Mark talks about, between the 40-yard lines, as he quotes Dennis Kucinich. But part of the trick of running an effective campaign is deciding what those 40-yard lines are going to be. And it seems like in the pivot section of the book, this is where Barack Obama was fairly effective in deciding what those 40-yard lines were going to be, particularly in equating Governor Romney with people who had lots of money and not a lot of concern for people who don't.
Well, one of the strategies of the Obama campaign this time, which is quite in contrast to what he did in 2008, is that a good portion of their thinking and resources and brainstorming went into the question of how do we disqualify Governor Romney as someone who people would think would be more capable than President Obama to deal with the economy. I mean, they knew that or they feared that if people looked at Governor Romney and said, you know, I may not agree with him on everything. He may be too conservative on some things for me, or I don't know about this or that. But I think that this is a person who knows what to do with the economy, in contrast to the president. That would have made this race much more challenging. And so, not only did the president focus on this middle class message, but a good part of their strategy was aimed at saying, Governor Romney was not an effective steward of the economy when he was governor, and when he was in the private sector, a number of the practices of companies he invested in were very harmful to middle-class workers.
Let us take another call. Here's Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dan Balz. His book is Collision 2012.
I've always thought that one of the big problems is we have way too much money floating around to pay for all these long drug-out things. Got to remember, as you're 18 to 48 years old, you're a soundbite person. You've grown up on it. You expect anything. After 14 seconds, you just tune out. That may be simplistic, but, you know, we had our choice of Mr. Romney with a history in the family of working with capital. On the other hand, we had an educated social worker, period. Don't go any farther than that. People in their 99% walking around the sidewalk in small town like I live in, I stopped some of them. I said, now, wait a minute. Don't we all live in the Northwest because we want to be kind of independent thinkers and not part of a herd? Isn't that what you're telling your children, not just be part of the blah, blah, blah? And they would all just stand there and kind of stare at me. But I think, you know, we have to remember from 18 to 48, I'm older than that, but most people are soundbiters.
Right, which makes it difficult, Jim. Thanks for the point to get a message across, doesn't it, Dan Balz?
Well, it does, and his point about being too much money. I mean, there was so much money sloshing around in these campaigns and the outside interest groups that people in the battleground states, in particular, you could not, you had to turn away from the ads. You could not watch them. They were, you know, they were so constant. I spent a fair amount of time in a number of the states and remember being in Ohio in the closing weeks and watching local news one night and just thinking, you know, it's mostly ads and not news. I mean, that the balance between the advertising and the news portion of the program had suddenly seeming like it was flipped upside down. And I don't know that there's any way out of the money issue, but I think that the advertising loses its efficiency over time because there's too much of it.
Yeah, this is the glut. I remember when Oregon is a battleground in the primaries, I guess, in 08, we got a lot of advertisements. And so, yeah, that sort of thing happened. The conversation is from 2013 with Dan Baltz about his book Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. We'll come back to the conversation and finish up our discussion about that last presidential election as we head into the next one. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment at today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're revisiting an interview from 2 years ago with Dan Baltz about his book Collision 2012 about the last race for the White House. We can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Let's finish this up. The Soundbite Society that Jim just talked about on his call, Dan, worked in different ways for the two candidates in this campaign, it seems like, because Barack Obama, I've read, deliberately tries to work his speeches so they don't lend themselves to sound bites. And Mitt Romney, on the other hand, seemed to get stuck with a couple of unfortunate sound bites, like I like firing people and the 47%.
Yeah, I mean, President Obama is a discursive speaker, and so he does not lend himself to sound bites. He's not the only presidential candidate I've covered who is that way, but he is not. He's not a sound biter. And, you know, in a sense, He dislikes a lot of that element of politics, and so, you know, he's done it his own way. Now he's obviously an eloquent speaker on the stump and an effective speaker, but not in a soundbite way. And as you say, Governor Romney's soundbites were one that were that came back to hurt him, off the cuff remarks as opposed to well crafted soundbites. I mean, you know, campaigns work particularly for debates to develop good zinger lines that seem like they are delivered spontaneously, but that they are looking for that soundbite moment. But for Governor Romney, the most memorable soundbites were ones that he would wish he had not uttered.
So, Benny, the point of Barack Obama not wanting to give sound bites, I mean, you've interviewed him and you've interviewed lots of other people who work with him on a regular basis. Is he different in demeanor from other political figures?
Well, I've interviewed him a few times. I did not interview him for this book, but I know that almost every time I've interviewed him, you know, with somebody like the president or a presidential candidate, you're given a specific amount of time for an interview, and usually it's much less than you really want.
Right.
And I remember a couple of interviews with candidate Obama and then President-elect Obama in which I started out with a kind of a strategy of how you want to do an interview and started down a couple of particular roads that I wanted to explore. And he tends to give long answers and he tends to speak slowly. And you can just, you know, if you, it's like you've got this, you know, this sand going through the hourglass, you can just see the time, you know, bleeding away in front of you as, you know, as he's talking slowly and circling an answer. And we see the same thing when he does a press conference. He actually gets very few questions, which is why, you know, if you watch a press conference now, reporters will ask two or three or four questions because, you know, he takes such a long time to answer. So it can be frustrating with him. On the other hand, he can be a very thoughtful interview, you know, not simply programmed. And I had one interview with him for the book I co-authored on the 2008 campaign, which was after he had been elected but before he had been sworn in. And it was just a very interesting interview because he opened up a little bit about how he saw the role of leadership in a president and the role of race in society and just his general feeling about the campaign. So he can be a very good interview, but he can be a tough interview.
Yeah, particularly when you've got a limited time and he's giving long answers. Let's go to Daryl in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dan Balls.
Hello. I love that last answer. Part of the reason I like Obama, I guess. Anyway, my question, my personal peeve is about, it kind of builds on the soundbite thing. My personal peeve is about buzzwords in corporate and political campaigns. And, for instance, small farmers was a big term used to defeat the GMO initiative in California because it obviously threatened the small farmers. And I tried to keep track of these in the 2012 election, and if I had a list, I lost it. I'm wondering how you feel about these things that evidently come up, are brought up by advertising agencies and consumer research. What was used in 2012? And
things like job-killing taxes?
In 2014 and 2016, and I can take my answer up here.
All right, thanks for that, Daryl.
Well, these are a staple of politics, just in the way, as Daryl suggests, they are a staple of the way business is done in this country, or the way most things are done now. A lot of stuff is, there's market research that goes into it. Language is poll tested, and you know what campaigns and candidates are looking for is the most concise way to make a significant point that resonates with people. I mean, the most obvious buzzwords in this campaign were middle class, and you know, not surprisingly, we've heard that from any number of Democratic candidates over the years. But this focus on the middle class, which was a relentless part of whatever President Obama talked about through the campaign, but we've seen it over the years. Whether it's the criticism of Democrats as tax and spend Democrats, Al Gore in 2000 said risky scheme so many times that campaign correspondents would turn away because they'd heard it so many times. So some of these things work, and some of them don't. But the campaigns go to great lengths to try to do what they can, in essence, to mask their deficiencies and to highlight their assets. And I think to some extent voters legitimately get tired of it and see through it. But sometimes it does work. It does have a resonance, and that that's part of what goes into an effective advertising strategy, whether it's in a political campaign or in commercial part of society.
Let us take another call. Ray in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dan Balls, the author of Collision 2012.
Good morning. I just had a couple of comments that I wanted your author's opinion on. First is, I hear a lot of people complaining about nothing being done in Washington and in state legislatures and things like that for the most part. And I truly believe that's because since the late 80s, early 90s, our country has almost been split 50-50. And whenever the country's opinions are 50-50, it's very difficult to get anything passed and get anything done. My second comment is, on the last election, during the election and after really looking at it, my opinion was that it came down to a significant number of people that carried this election as the Republicans offering Americans a hand and Democrats offering them a handout, and the handout generations made up that difference that made the vote go Obama's way. Just wanted the comments on that.
All right, thanks for that, Ray. Well, that is the 47% that Mitt Romney was talking about. They rely on government resources, right?
Yeah, and I mean it was mangled language at best, and obviously damaging for him in the way it came out. When I talked to him about that, I think he was still, in a sense, processing what had happened. When I mentioned he had said, as he did, that 47% of the country, he could never convince them to take personal responsibility for their own lives. He said, "I didn't say that." We know that was what he said. I think in his heart of hearts, whatever he said was not what he believes he believes, and that he thinks that, that was just a bad moment for him. But he knew that it played into the idea that he was insensitive about the lives of a lot of ordinary Americans, and that it had a damaging effect. On the question of nothing getting done in Washington and state legislatures, I draw a distinction. I think we've been more or less paralyzed in Washington for for a number of years, because there is this 50-50 division, because there's a split control with the Republicans having the House of Representatives and the ability to mount filibusters in the Senate, and the Democrats having a majority of the Senate but not 60 and holding the White House, and each party, I think, believing that if they just hold out to the next election, maybe they will be in a stronger position to do more of what they want to do, and so they won't have to compromise. I think we're seeing something different in state legislatures right now. What we're seeing is that there are a number of states where Republicans have control of both the governor's office and the legislature.
Wisconsin comes to mind.
Well, you know, Wisconsin or North Carolina or Texas or any, you know, Kansas or any number of places, and they're moving in one direction. I mean, they tend to be implementing some conservative policies, whether it's on social policies or economic policies. And in Democratic states, I think we're seeing some other things where, you know, where taxes are not off the table, where there is, you know, there's more money being put into things like infrastructure and that sort of thing. And so I think there's a kind of a divergence now between red and blue America in the states. But at the national level, when it all comes up in one large bundle, we're still at a point where it's been difficult to get either side to compromise enough to reach consensus to move certain things forward.
Another call here from Cynthia and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dan Balz, the author of Collision 2012.
Yeah, Dan, I just wanted to make a couple comments. I was a little bit troubled by a couple of things you said, and I wanted to give you a chance to talk further about. For instance, the Occupy movement, I don't think we should dismiss it. I think a lot of people were influenced by it. I don't think they ever intended to become a permanent presence. A lot of these folks who were involved in Occupy are now very active in MoveOn.org and the Move to Amend, which would, be a way to get big money out of campaigns. And I just wanted to ask you to please give them more than just a nod, because I think that they are influential and would step it up with a future campaign.
All right, so you're saying the Occupy movement never really wanted to be like the Tea Party movement.
They were not. That was not. They were into situational leadership, which mm-hmm. is where people step up and lead for a while when there's a need, and then they step back, and then somebody else steps up. And personally, I think that's the way out of the mess that we're in. I think that this old, old white men, form of leadership that we've had for so long, the patriarchy is crumbling, and it's time to find new ways to organize our leadership.
All right. Thanks for that, Cynthia. Dan, thoughts?
My point was that they had a big influence on sort of the broader conception of the economic debate, the 1% versus the 99%. And the issue of more broadly of income inequality. That was not at all on the radar screen in any significant way before the Occupy movement assembled. And it became a staple of the backdrop of the debate over the economy. So in that sense, they made a significant contribution, as I indicated. My point on the political organization is there are a lot of ways for people in different movements to organize. And Cynthia makes an important point on that. But what I was trying to suggest was that in terms of becoming active in, as in essence, an adjunct to the Obama campaign in the way that the Tea Party movement in different states became an adjunct of the Republican Party, I don't think that ever happened. Now, Cynthia may think that's the wrong way to go, and a lot of people in the movement probably do think that's the wrong way to go. But when you are weighing and trying to analyze that movement's impact on the 2012 presidential race versus what the Tea Party did in 2010, I just think they're two different organizations with different effects, and people on both sides, whether they were in the Republican Party or particularly in the Obama campaign, were kind of eyeing the Occupy movement in those early stages, trying to figure out what effect it might have and whether it could be harnessed, if you will, or or augmented in one way or another. So that was the point I was trying to make.
Mm-hmm. To the Tea Party itself, which you refer to in the book as the Apocalypse Party, I mean, don't we, if not need necessarily, want purists in the process, because they will extend the discussion, the debate outside the 40-yard lines, as the early reference went, because they're required to think about things that aren't really necessarily in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think it's valuable to have voices in the debate who are bringing new ideas to the table, who are in a sense challenging the orthodoxy of either party, either from within the party or without. And you know, sometimes those ideas take a long time to take root. They may come up at the beginning of a campaign and not really have much influence in that particular cycle, but they might sometime after that. And so, go back to the Occupy issue. I mean, we don't know at this point what role the issue of income inequality may play in the 2016 election. We certainly know that not a lot has happened on that front to suggest that there's been much change in a positive direction in that, and nor in fact in just in terms of sort of the general well-being of the middle class. And so those are issues that that could come to the fore again as a result of some of the seeding that was done in an earlier time.
It is a good read in great detail. Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. Dan Balse is the chief correspondent at the Washington Post, and he wrote it. Dan, thanks so much.
Jeff, thank you very much.